It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a unique slice of nature in southwestern Wisconsin, one you might not expect to find in our state.
First, Congresswoman Gwen Moore and Senator Tammy Baldwin send a letter to U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch about the slow pace of the federal investigation into the death of Dontre Hamilton. Milwaukee police officer Christopher Manny shot and killed Hamilton during a struggle at a park. Hamilton was African-American, unarmed, and mentally ill. The Milwaukee County District Attorney did not issue charges against Officer Manny, but the police department's internal investigation determined he didn't follow the correct procedures. He was fired from the police department in October.
Congresswoman Gwen Moore joins us now. She represents Wisconsin's 4th District, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Moore, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
So why did you and Senator Baldwin decide to write this letter to the Attorney General?
Well, we had heard from the family. We had developed a relationship with the family. And they and others in the community were really frustrated by having this issue hang out there and be unresolved. It's been 14 months since Dontre's death. And, you know, Maria Hamilton and her son, Nate, are still in constant agony and anguish, and they have been supported in the community and just waiting to hear some answers.
And have you got an answer to this letter from the Attorney General's office?
Unfortunately, we have not. We did receive a letter acknowledging receipt of the request, but we have not heard what the disposition of the case is.
As we mentioned, the county's district attorney didn't issue charges against Officer Manny. The department did fire him. However, what are you hoping comes out of a federal investigation that hasn't been tackled already at the local level?
Well, we are curious as to whether or not Dontre's civil rights were violated. We are confused, perplexed at how a young man lying on a park bench, how that could have escalated into his death. He was unarmed. He wasn't bothering anybody. There had been two police officers who had come by prior to Officer Manning encountering Mr. Hamilton, and they had checked it out and didn't see where there was any particular problem. And to the extent that the Fire and Police Commission upheld the firing, and the police chief indicated that Officer Manning had not followed police procedures in encountering him, we want to close the loop with a federal investigation.
As I understand it, it's only been about 6 months since the U.S. attorney said there would be this federal review of the case. That could mean that there's a slow, exhaustive investigation going on, but it sounds like you're worried that it's not that, it's that this is on the back burner.
Well, we don't know whether it's on the back burner or not. That's the point. We haven't heard. We want at least at a minimum an update on the status of it. Anything. Just tell us that it's being reviewed, or it's being reviewed by, it's in the second level of review. We just want to hear something.
We're talking to Representative Gwen Moore from Wisconsin. She and Senator Tammy Baldwin wrote a letter to the Attorney General's office looking for a faster, more expedited investigation into the death of Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee. On a wider level, you're also calling for more attention to a pattern and practice review of the Milwaukee Police Department. As I understand it, not just about this particular instance, but about wider procedures and policies. What are you looking for there?
Well, Rob, I can tell you as almost a lifelong resident of Milwaukee, this is not new, Dontre Hamilton's death. We have Derek Williams, but I can recall all the way back to 1981. My mother then, with only 5 years left to live, she was so infirm, but she was even motivated to go out into the street to protest the death of Ernie Lacy. Ernie Lacy, as your listeners might recall, was an African-American man that had been painting an apartment building and left to run over to the local little 7-Eleven store, I believe it was, to get some snacks, and was encountered by the police because he supposedly fit the description of a rapist in that neighborhood. And they basically put, I believe it was sort of like a vasovenal reaction that was determined that he was basically choked and strangled to death. And so, as a result of that, if there were anything that was good that came out of that, I think the police stopped using that particular hold on suspects. And in fact, the police then were, it was determined that they didn't offer him assistance during the arrest. And so this is not a new phenomenon in Milwaukee.
Now, there's been a lot of talk since the Dontre Hamilton shooting. Do you see from community conversations, from the back and forth between members of the police department, city leadership, and local community, do you see any improvement happening apart from the federal investigation?
Well, I can tell you that there are many problems in Milwaukee. There's a lot of distrust in the community. You know, as you also may recall, and the listeners may recall, we just had the egregious case that is sort of still going on about the invasive body cavity searches. And we're real clear that it's impossible for the police to deliver the services to protect and serve if there's a breakdown in communication and trust in the community that is allowed to fester and hang out there. So we think that that relationship, to the extent that it exists, is really frail, and it is at risk, and we must address that relationship.
Now, you and Senator Baldwin have written to the Attorney General. As we wrap up, what are you hoping comes out of that letter? What response are you looking for here?
You know, I think the family, both the family and the community, need some answers. They need some closure. They need to feel that they have some pittance of justice for the very untimely death of Dontre Hamilton. Again, you know, if Dontre Hamilton were, you know, shooting at the police or conducting himself in some other way where police officers were at risk, then none of this, there would be no protests in the street. But, you know, the notion that a young black man can be just lying on a public park bench and turn up dead is very, very unsettling.
Representative Moore, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Gwen Moore, Congresswoman from Wisconsin's 4th District, which includes Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about the letter that she and Senator Tammy Baldwin wrote, expressing concern about what they call the slow pace of the federal investigation into Dontre Hamilton's death. Now, from outer space, we head to a place in Wisconsin that might feel a little alien to state residents. Here in the state, we've got lakes and rivers and forests. Believe it or not, there's one place in Wisconsin which is kind of like a desert.
Yep, no kidding. The Spring Green Preserve, sometimes known as the Wisconsin Desert, boasts numerous desert-like animals and plants, including prickly pear cactus, if you can believe it.
Here to tell us more about this unique Wisconsin area is Hannah Spall. She's Director of Conservation Land Management in Wisconsin for the Nature Conservancy, which manages the Spring Green Preserve. Hannah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very much. Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we've all lived through a Wisconsin winter or two, so it can be kind of hard to wrap our minds around the concept of a desert-like part of the state. How did this place come to be? What makes it different from the rest of the state?
Well, the preserve and the area around it, it's part of the original floodplain of the Wisconsin River, and there's just a lot of sand in the area, and so the bluffs and the flat areas at the base of the bluff are very sandy soils, and so when it rains, that soil just infiltrates very, very quickly into the ground, leaving a very dry xeric site, and it is host then to a suite of species that tend to do very well in dry, sandy conditions.
And to be clear, this is not an actual desert, but it's pretty darn desert-like, it sounds like.
It is. I mean, it rains the same amount there as it would rain in other parts in southern Wisconsin. The difference is that the soil just doesn't hold that moisture at all, and the preserve has a lot of south-facing aspects to it, so the bluffs face towards the south, and so it's a combination of the moisture infiltrating into the ground really quickly, but also an incredible amount of sun exposure, and so things just dry out very, very fast there.
And, of course, this doesn't have the heat that would feature in your, you know, movie screen type deserts, the Saharas of the world and things like that. But, as I understand it, at least one kind of cactus is successful there. We usually don't see that around the state.
There is. There's a prickly pear cactus, and you do not need to be an experienced botanist to find it. It is everywhere, and it's all over the preserve. It's from the minute you get out of the parking lot and start hiking, you'll really notice it. It's not a tall cactus. It's something that stays fairly low to the ground, but it's very, very well established and really thrives on the site. And I would argue that if you were out on the preserve in the middle of the day this time of year, it would definitely feel like a desert. The sun really beats down, and it gets very, very hot out there.
What about other critters and plants that are desert-like and unusual to Wisconsin?
There's just a tremendous number of insects on the preserve. This time of year is a really wonderful time to go and visit a lot of butterflies that are out on the preserve. There's also some species of tiger beetles and some leaf hoppers. So although one might not get super excited at first glance at some of those insects, they are species that are really uncommon and favoring some of those drier habitats. So they're really nice to have there. A really fun thing, you don't usually see them there, but you see the evidence of them. The place has a lot of pocket gophers, and so you see a lot of the burrows and the disturbance of those animals.
What's a pocket gopher?
It's a gopher native to Wisconsin, and it lives underground, but it eats a lot of the prairie vegetation, insects, and you know whatever it can find to eat. But it's you see these tunnels, raised mounds and tunnels that are riddled all throughout the preserve. They tend to be active at night, so they're hard to find during the day. And then there's a wonderful set of species of birds that are found on the preserve. You can find meadow larks, grasshopper sparrows, lark sparrows, dick thistles, and just a really lovely variety of species that both migrate through earlier in the spring, but then also a lot of nesting birds that are found in the prairie.
And Hannah, when I think desert, I think of the reptiles, the spiders, the scorpions of the world. Do we see any of those at the Spring Green Preserve?
Certainly some lovely spiders can be found there. Wolf spiders are found there. And there are some reptiles on the property, and they tend to be fairly secretive and a little bit harder to see, but they are definitely there. Yeah.
Talking to Hannah Spall with the Nature Conservancy about the Spring Green Preserve, a bit of desert-like terrain here in Wisconsin. Hannah, I understand that as the site gets more popular, that brings some dangers to the site. So if people go and they want to visit, can you give us the rules of Wisconsin's desert so we get to keep it for a while?
Sure. And it really is a lovely place to go, and it's very accessible, so we really do encourage people to get out there and experience the place. The things I would most advise people of, there is a very nicely maintained trail that you can access from the parking lot, and it's about a mile and a half out and back trail that leads up from, it'll go through the prairie, it'll follow along the base of the bluff, and then it wraps around and goes up a hill to the top of the bluff, and you can look out over a really broad landscape of the lower Wisconsin River. Some things to advise people of, we do ask that people stay on the trail. The trail has been placed in a way that is not going to negatively impact vegetation, so we ask that people stay on that trail. A lot of the vegetation there is sensitive to foot traffic, so if a lot of people are walking off the trail and stepping on those delicate cacti and other plants, that will have an impact over time. So we encourage and ask people to stay on the trail, and then we also request that, people leave the plants and animals undisturbed. So no collecting and no disturbing of plants or wildlife that's observed, but just enjoy what you can see from the trail. Take a camera with you, but as they say, leave only footprints.
Are there any particular challenges to managing this pretty unique area of land here in Wisconsin?
There are. It's, you know, challenges and opportunities. The site is what we refer to as fire-dependent, and by that we mean that a lot of the species thrive and do well when they are in a system that is subject to fire. So this area of Wisconsin used to have wildfires go through it on a regular basis, somewhere between annually to every 3 years. And the species that are there really evolved and adapted to that fire going through. The fires moved through most of southern Wisconsin in that fashion. So today, as land managers, one of our biggest opportunities and challenges is to make sure that we continue to apply that fire. And today we do that in the form of prescribed fires under very specific weather conditions, and everybody is trained and experienced in the use of prescribed fire. But we want to make sure that we're able to continue to get that tool out on the landscape. And there are just some logistical challenges in making that happen. And we do a lot of burning around the state in southern Wisconsin in general. So this is one of the places that we really prioritize being able to get that management out there.
And Hannah, before we let you go, I wanted to ask, is there, and don't say all of them, is there a best time of year to visit and see what's going on at Spring Green Preserve?
Well, I think the name says it for me, and that I would say is in the springtime. The wildflower blooming in sort of May and April is really lovely, and certainly the cactus bloom in mid-June, so that is a really, really lovely time to be out there as well. But as you might guess, there's something out there for everybody during all seasons.
Hannah, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
That was Hannah Spall, Director of Conservation Land Management in Wisconsin for the Nature Conservancy. She joined us to talk about the Spring Green Preserve, which features a little patch of desert right here in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear the latest on Milwaukee's residency requirement.
First, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released its Kids Count data book yesterday. It's an annual report that looks at the well-being of children nationally and state by state using an index of 16 different indicators. This year's report shows there are more kids living in poverty now than during the Great Recession, even though the economy seems to have recovered.
And we're taking your calls on this. Why do you think there are more kids living in poverty now than during the recession? What policies do you think could help to lift these kids out of poverty? How do you think kids in Wisconsin are faring? And what are you seeing in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Ken Taylor is with us now for a look at the report and what it says about how kids are doing in Wisconsin. He's the executive director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on your program.
So, Ken, we'll spend some time on the bad news behind some of the numbers here, poverty and other issues. But I want to start maybe with some upside. Wisconsin ranking 13th in overall well-being for children. On the positive side, what fed into that number?
Well, I think that one of the things that we do quite well at is some aspects of our education system. So some of the good news in this report are around high school graduation, which is relatively high across the board, though not consistently in all races and ethnicities, and also teen birth rates that are going down. So I think this reflects the fact that, you know, historically we have invested in kids and families, and this overall top-tier ranking reflects that.
Now, this report takes the latest available numbers, pretty much 2013, and the big headline has been that poverty for kids seems to be on the rise compared even with the outbreak of the Great Recession. Similar story here in Wisconsin?
It is, unfortunately. The good news here is that our poverty rate for children is slightly lower than the national average. The bad news is that it's growing faster, so that means that we're catching up to the national average, and that's of concern. And what that means in our state is nearly 250,000 children live below poverty, which for a family of three is roughly $20,000 a year.
Now, long term, what are some of the consequences for kids who grow up in poverty? What risks does that put them at?
Well, it puts them at risk for a whole host of challenges later in life. So we know that educationally there's more challenges. We know that their future employment prospects are dimmer. We know that when it comes to their health, they don't live as long, and they have more challenges in their health. So we know that the long-term negative impacts are significant, and a lot of that has to do with the stress that kids and families are under when they live in poverty.
And what do you see the state needing to do to tackle some of those issues to hopefully lift kids out of poverty?
Well, we think that we need to take a two-generation approach. So we need a holistic look at both families and children. Too often our systems to support people are focused on one or the other, and obviously children grow up in families. Many grown-ups are parents, and so we need to look more broadly at both generations, or even three generations, but at least two generations simultaneously. And so what that means for parents is having access to family-supporting jobs that pay adequate income to boost them out of poverty, and having the skills to do that work in the current environment. And for kids, it means high-quality early care and education in particular, because we know that that has a great return on that investment, but also high-quality education throughout their education career. And then the links between those two, so the systems to link parents and their kids, so that they're not having to make choices between being a good employee and being a good parent. And too often we place low-income parents in that situation where it's difficult to do both.
Talking to Ken Taylor with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, looking at the new Kids Count data book just out this week, looks at child well-being around the country and state by state, a number of different measures, finds an increase in poverty nationwide and here in Wisconsin among kids, even compared to the beginning of the Great Recession. I want to talk, Ken, about racial disparities. You've been studying that for years now, recent reports before this new one. How does that fit into the research that's involved in this report?
Well, the overall high ranking, in top tier, 13th rank, really masks some deep racial disparities in our state. So so I think we should be proud that we're a top tier, although, we have neighbors in the upper Midwest that are doing significantly better than that. But even with that said, when you look at the well-being of kids of color in our state, we are at the bottom. So, in fact, this earlier report that you referenced called Race for Results showed that the well-being of African-American kids in our state was the worst in the nation, and the well-being of the Asian kids in our state was also in the bottom tier. And so this high ranking overall, because we have such a high proportion of white kids in our state, mask these challenges that we have within communities of color. And it really is about the systems that we have and the challenges that they present that are driving these disparities.
One of the indicators that the national report we're talking about looked at was children growing up in areas of concentrated poverty, kids growing up in very poor neighborhoods, not just families. Is that something we see in Wisconsin, maybe something that disproportionately affects African-American kids in the state?
It does. So we do see that, and we see that it is getting worse here. It is also getting worse across the country. And the thing that is challenging about this is that it's not only the poor kids who grow up in these high poverty areas that have challenges, but even the non-poor kids do worse when they live in communities that have concentrated poverty than if they were to live in other communities. So So it's not only affecting the kids that grow up in poor families. And the, you know, there are challenges in the urban areas of our state, and certainly in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee has some of the highest levels of any urban area in the country around this concentrated poverty, which then does affect kids of color, and particularly African-American kids in Milwaukee.
Well, and the huge question then is, how do you target changes that will help those communities where there is this concentrated poverty, racial communities where we have this disparity? What is proven out there, if anything, that's going to help deal with that?
Right. And I would say that there is this concentration of poverty in our urban areas, but poverty is growing all over the state. So if you look at the map where the growth of poverty, you know, it's not just in the urban areas of our state. There's significant increases, you know, in the western and northern parts of the state as well. So the solutions that we come up with to address this also need to work where there aren't concentrations of people at all, right, where they're in rural areas of our state. So it doesn't reflect that particular challenge doesn't show up in this statistic, but it is very much real across rural parts of and northern parts and western parts of our state. So we think that the solution to this goes back to this two-generation approach. And, you know, there are some big challenges there, particularly when we're talking about, you know, having access to family-supporting jobs, when most of the job growth in our state is in poverty-level, low-income jobs. So, and this is a national challenge, but to the extent that we see job growth, the vast majority of it, you can still work full-time and have your family be in poverty. So that's one of the challenges that are sort of broader economic challenges. But also this idea, this concern that we have around it being difficult for you know, difficult for low-income parents to be both good employees and hold down a good job, and the challenges that presents when the pay isn't very good, and also what it takes to be good parents and be able to go to you know, take care of your kid when they're sick. Many of these jobs don't have sick time or ability to leave to go to a school meeting or things like that. So we have to create a system that allows parents to succeed in the workplace and also succeed as parents.
We're talking to Ken Taylor with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about the just-released Kids Count data book. This year's data shows more children are living in poverty now than at the beginning of the Great Recession.
And we're taking your calls. Are you surprised to hear that more Wisconsin children are living in poverty now, even though the recession is more or less over? And how do things look in your community? What do you think should change to help Wisconsin kids be more successful? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're picking up our discussion now with Ken Taylor from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families about the annual Kids Count report. He says this year's data shows some hopeful signs and a lot of room for improvement.
We're taking your calls on this. What do you think Wisconsin should do differently to help children in the state have more opportunities for success? What policies do you think would help the state's most vulnerable population, kids living in poverty? How can we overcome racial disparities? How do things look on the ground where you live, in your community? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Andy on the line in West Bend. Andy, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, thank you for having the show. It's very interesting.
Oh, what do you think, Andy?
Here's what I see is a disparity in wealth in this country is just has gone to pre-depression levels. we've moved back in that. We're moving back as far as the unions go down. The people that hold up the middle class are being set back. We're seeing wages go down. The laws are pushing back again to allow younger people to work, kids back in the workforce. You got people like Scott Walker blasting the minimum wage, saying we don't need it. And as long as there's money, I guess my point is that as long as there's money in politics and such an influence of big money and dark money in politics, I don't see our politicians making any changes in favor of the general populace. It just seems that it goes more and more for the wealthiest.
Andy, I want to jump in and get our guest in on this. Ken, as he paints it, there's a lot stacked up against the kind of changes you're hoping for to tackle child poverty and other children-related issues. Do you have any hope of movement on some of the things you're hoping will change?
Well, I do, because I think, Andy is right that we are seeing disparities in wealth go to pre-depression levels. The distinction actually is an important one, the distinction between income and wealth, because wealth is something that gets passed on from generation to generation. And so when we look at income disparities, they're bad, but when you look at wealth, it's even worse. And the thing is that there are corrections that happen because people understand that this is not a sustainable path that we're on. So there are big forces and powerful forces that are allayed against this. But as more and more people understand that the system is not supporting regular families, and that we do need to sort of take action more broadly to say, we have a shared fate. We used to believe in this thing called the common good, and we need to get back there because the benefits of the hard work aren't going to the people who are doing the work, and so we need to get back to a point where that is increasingly the case. It's not that the wealthy can't stay wealthy, but the inequities are growing even more, and so they need to be more broadly shared.
Andy, thanks for that call. We'll get back to callers in just a minute. I wanted to ask you about one other element from the KC Foundation's recommendations having to do with early childhood education. How important do you see that? How are we doing here in Wisconsin on that?
Well, early childhood education, I think, is one of the really important keys, and I can't overemphasize how important that is. Not only is it the right thing to do for the kids, but it's really a smart investment to make. So we have some of the strongest social science research that tells us that the return on investment is very strong, better than the stock market, and this is Jim Heckman, who's an economist from the University of Chicago. He's a Nobel laureate telling us this, and he's not the only one, but he's certainly one of them. And we also know so much from brain development research and the brain science about just how prolific the development is in those first 5 years. And I think any parent with a young child will tell you, it's amazing how much they learn in a day. Or, a grandparent who hasn't seen their grandchild for a month, they're coming back to a kid that knows so much more that next month. And so I think we all experience that. And so we need a system that supports that. We also know that most young kids have, all their available parents, either if it's one or both, working. 75% of young kids in Wisconsin have their parents working. So we know that is a requirement in most families, and so we need to have a system that supports that, and we know that the investment pays long-term dividends.
We're talking to Ken Taylor. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, looking at the new Kids Count data report, looking at poverty and other issues facing children around the country and state by state, including here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers now with Harry on the line in Madison. Harry, hi.
Yes, hi. Our economy has changed. We have exported so many of our jobs and offshored so many of our factories that they're not the same jobs that they used to be. And the second thing I would like you to take into your calculus is the question of educational ethic. My mother was just a domestic worker. She taught me to read before I went to school and taught me to love education and to respect my teachers. And consequently, I have 5 degrees, and nobody ever helped me to go to school. In this country, anybody can get an education if they want to. Thank you.
Harry, thanks a lot for the call. So he's saying, Ken, part of the solution is, rich or poor, we need to instill an educational ethic in both generations, parents and children.
Yeah, and I would agree. The question that that I would have for Harry is that opportunity really equally available to all? And so, we look at the opportunities that my kid might have, and then compare that to some of the opportunities that low-income children might have and low-income kids of color. Now it sounds like, Harry definitely beat the odds, right? And that is to be commended, and that is, one of the great things about America and about Wisconsin, that can happen. But I would argue that we also need to change the odds so it's not so exceptional, and that more people actually do have the opportunity, because if you look in certain areas, I think it's pretty clear to folks that some people can make it out of dire circumstances, but it's quite a bit harder.
Harry, thanks for the call. Harry also brought up just a structural change that those manufacturing jobs where someone maybe with a high school education could make, in effect, a middle-class salary to raise a family on. They just aren't out there as much anymore. Is that just an element that's really beyond our control that we're just going to have to kind of live with, Ken?
Yeah, well, there's no question that that is a major contributor to sort of the hollowing out of the middle of our economy. But I think that there are other kinds of family supporting jobs that can be created. While the manufacturing sector, has taken a hit, we're still one of the heavy manufacturing states that still plays a larger role here. And we need to evolve. We need to create other types of family supporting jobs. This is an economy, and this is a country that has figured out big challenges before. So just accepting that there's no way to have a robust middle class anymore, I just don't believe that.
So looking at this report, what kind of things are you hoping that leaders, maybe the legislature at city and state level, take out of this and do with the numbers that are in here?
Well, again, I think the acknowledgement and the understanding about the long-term implications of poverty, particularly for our kids, and that understanding that it's unfortunately getting worse, not better. And so we need to take action to address this, and that it's not just in the best interest of the kids who are growing up in poverty and their families, but it's really in our collective best interest, because we know that when these kids do better, we all do better, and also that the long-term negative implications are quite costly. So we need to invest, and what we need to invest in is world-class education from birth to career that prepares kids and adults for the economy of the 21st century. And we also need to sort of, I would say, regain and energize the common good and the common ground, this shared fate that I think we need to reinvigorate, because we really do need to do this together.
Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
That was Ken Taylor. He's executive director for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He was with us to talk about the 2015 Kids Count Report, which showed that Wisconsin ranks 13th when it comes to overall well-being for children.